Native Americans, both those Native Americans who sided with the British and those who were stupid enough to side with the white settlers. Whichever side they took, they were decimated after the rebellion, because the plan of the white settlers was to create not just a white man's nation, but a white man's continent. Every single white person in the new United States understood as a fundamental fact of the War of Independence that the masses of black people opposed their project, opposed the formation of their nation. It was a founding fact and principle of the United States that the black population could be expected to make common cause with other forces, with other nations, with other peoples in their fight against white supremacy here at home. That was the lesson that the new nation learned in that war. That's not what they teach us in school, but that was the overarching fact. The millions, the white settlers organized according to that fact, according to the arraignment of forces, according to what they learned about what the slave would do if he got a chance. The northern states began to undermine slavery, not because they liked black folks, but because they wanted to keep the numbers of black folks down so that they would not be in their communities creating a clear and present danger to white society. The southern states deepened the oppression of black people. The founding fathers wrote into the Constitution that there would be no discussion of slavery for 20 years, that the subject was off the table. Do not encourage these Negroes to think that there's even any possibility of an end to slavery. For the new nation, black people were a national security issue, and that has been the case since 1776 and before. The best recent writing on this subject is from Dr. Gerald Horn. Many of you may know about him. He's a professor of African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's written a book called Negro Comrades of the Crown, and it chronicles the history of our people's willingness and our eagerness to ally ourselves with those who present an alternative to the rule of our domestic enemies. That is a history that has been buried not only by white supremacists, not only by the U.S. government and its educational institutions, but also by those Negroes who want to paint a picture of black loyalty to the oppressive U.S. state. But black people were not loyal to their oppressors and made friends wherever they could in order to get rid of the master. The memories of the black alliance with the British were rekindled in the United States as it geared up for another war with Britain in the early 1800s. Black slave rebellions had broken out in the early 1800s across the South, and they were viewed in stark terms of national security, especially because everyone was anticipating another war with Great Britain. And you have to remember that the War of 1812 was closer in time to the American settler rebellion than the war in Vietnam is to us. This was an active memory that the slaves had fought against the country in its birth, and here they are sided with the British, and here come the British again. So we have to watch out for these slaves. The U.S. rulers remembered quite well what had happened. In fact, in 1811, just a year before the outbreak of war, one of the biggest slave rebellions in U.S. history broke out in Louisiana, as hundreds of Africans tried to march on New Orleans, and it was crushed, and at least 100 were beheaded and their heads stuck on pipes all along the road to New Orleans. The fear that the black slave population would revolt in coordination with a British invasion led ultimately to the greatest humiliation of the United States on the battlefield in the history of the country. The British attacked in 1814 in Maryland, and they overwhelmed the American militias. Then they marched south, and they burned the U.S. Capitol, and they burned the White House, and they burned anything else that they wanted to in the nation's capital. Now, right across the Potomac River was the state of Virginia. That was the home of Thomas Jefferson and George Washington. It was the center of the earlier rebellion, and it was the biggest state in the country, and it had the strongest militia in the country. The Virginians could see across the Potomac. They could see the White House burning and the Capitol burning, but the Virginia militias failed to fully mobilize to save the nation's capital, to save the country from humiliation at the hands of the British. And the reason was they were afraid that if they left Virginia to fight the British, then the slaves would rise up, just like they did in the the War of Rebellion. When the British governor, first act that he passed, with the Declaration of Independence, was to say that the slaves of Virginia are free if they come to our lines. So that's where the Black Rebellion began, and they thought they were going to see a repeat of it, and for that reason they let the Capitol burn rather than let the black folks revolt. Among those British soldiers who were burning Washington were 200 black runaway slaves who had escaped to the British forces, because the British for 2 years had blockaded the coast of the east coast of the United States, and they occupied islands and they sent raids in until they could defeat Napoleon and then really get a big army to come in. And so they already had a large force of black folks who had escaped from these coastal areas, and they organized them into something they called the Corps of Colonial Marines. And this Corps of Black Colonial Marines, who were from the neighborhood, took part in the humiliation of the United States at Washington. Today, some black folks make a great commotion about the fact that slave labor built the U.S. Capitol and the White House. But in 1814, and for generations afterwards, white folks were keenly aware that black ex-slaves in British uniforms helped to burn that sucker down. And they took that quite personal. Where black people are with guns, a danger to the national security of the United States? Damn right they were a danger. Would black men make common cause with a foreign power to strike at the U.S. government, which held their families in chain? Gladly they would make common cause, and they proved it over and over again. These same black Marines were later posted by the British to a base right here in Florida. Florida at that time was officially a colony of Spain, and when the war with the Americans ended in 1815, the British withdrew and the Spanish in small forces came back. But hundreds of those former Marines, some of them veterans of the burning of Washington, stayed in Florida, and they stayed at a place that became known as the Negro Fort. In 1816, these black soldiers and other escaped slaves who were in Florida, plus a number of Seminole Indians, and of course the families of the Seminole and the escaped black folks, all settled around there. It became a community of about 800 people. The Americans attacked under General Andrew Jackson. And in the attack, which was by gunboats, they got off a lucky shot, and the shot hit the gunpowder magazine at the fort, and it blew up, and it killed almost everybody. Virtually everyone was wiped out. The whites were jubilant at the destruction of this symbol of slave insurrection. But the Seminoles, who had lost about 30 or 40 of their people as well, they were very angry at the attack, and that became the start of the First Seminole War. In that war, blacks fought alongside the Seminole Nation, and they sought protection under the flag of the Spanish in a fight against the United States. In the Second Seminole War, in which blacks were also deeply involved, that one lasted until 1842, a war of black folks against the United States. 1842, that's less than 20 years before the U.S. Civil War. We have most of the whole first half of the 1800s, black people at war with the United States. And they've forgotten. It was an everyday accepted fact that given the chance, black people would take up arms against the United States, that we were indeed a national security threat. I've purposely not mentioned the well-known slave insurrections of Denmark Vesey in Charleston in 1822 or Nat Turner in Virginia in 1831. Everybody here is such a smart crowd, we don't have to go into detail. You're all familiar with that. We all know about the multiracial assault on the United States arsenal at Harper's Ferry, Virginia, in 1859. That was put down by United States Marines, who were under the control of United States General Robert E. Lee. People don't seem to remember that John Brown's raid was against the United States. It was not against Virginia. It was against the United States. It was the attack on the United States at Harper's Ferry that set the stage for the Civil War. Lincoln's election the next year was the catalyst, but the prospect of black revolt was the cause of the war. It was a foregone conclusion after that raid that there was going to be war. After recounting this steady stream of examples of black people's willingness to take up arms against the United States, either by themselves or in concert with Native Americans or with Europeans, after going through that list, is there any doubt in anyone's minds that Africans were considered to be a national security threat by the white folks and certainly the government of the United States? There was no doubt. That's why there was such great trepidation on the part of the North about arming the Negro in the Civil War. It was about whether he would be loyal and trustworthy when he was armed. Black people didn't have to prove that they would fight. He'd been fighting this man for all of the 1800s up to that time. The real question was, what would happen to the white man's country if blacks were given permission to carry guns and to kill white people? They'd already proven to be a national danger to the security of this white man's society. If in the 40-something years since they had opposed the founding of the Republic, Lincoln, however, found that he had no choice but to arm the blacks if he was to save the white nation. He would rather not have done so. In his first State of the Union address in 1861, he proposed that the Congress pay to have blacks sent out of the country, send them anywhere, just not here. Lincoln believed firmly, and he repeated it constantly, that there could never be peace with black people in the country. Their very presence was an existential threat to the country, a national security threat. And this guy was considered a liberal of his day. As we all know, black people in the South were subjugated by armed force not long after the Civil War. We call that the death of Reconstruction. And it was only then that white folks could declare some kind of peace in the land. the surviving black military units, the surviving formerly black Union forces, was then sent to kill Indians and thus make some kind of contribution to national security. In 1898, blacks, of course, were there for the U.S. Involvement in Cuba. But as soon as the hostilities with the Spanish were over, they quickly sent the black soldiers out of Cuba because they looked too damn much like the Cuban revolutionaries who had almost defeated the Spanish, by the way, when the Americans intervened to save them. And so they got them away from these Cubans right quick. Of course, the United States then saved the Philippines from the Spanish and then saved the Philippines from the Filipinos themselves, in the process killing a million of them. Black troops were there, but they found that the black troops were getting much too close to the Filipinos. Now, you have to understand, and many people have written about this, when the white troops would go into battle in the Philippines, they got confused. They couldn't figure out whether to call the enemy niggers or Injuns. It just was confusing to them. But they were very upset about the fraternizing of the black troops with the Filipinos. In fact, 1,000 black soldiers married Filipino women in the short space of time that they allowed them to stay in the Philippines. They quickly transferred the black troops out of there so that they wouldn't make common cause and solidarity with anybody else. Right after the U.S. Occupation and colonization of the Philippines, Teddy Roosevelt stages what he had all of the cruisers painted white, and for 2 years they sailed around the world. This is the Great White Fleet. Of course, militarily, this made no sense whatsoever, because the sky is blue and the ocean's blue, and you paint these boats white, they're easy targets for gunners. But it was all racist propaganda that this was the Great White Fleet, and the United States had assumed its position on the world stage in defense of white civilization. They were the guardians of white civilization. In 1906, black soldiers in Brownsville, Texas, at an altercation in town, one white bartender was killed and a white policeman was wounded. President Teddy Roosevelt, who said that he loved the black troops so much in Cuba, dishonorably discharged 167 black soldiers. In fact, there were fears at the time that the United States would disband the colored troops entirely after Brownsville. The United States begins World War I with the Houston Rebellion. It was in 1917. Black soldiers at Fort Logan, which was outside Houston, Texas, they were tired of being harassed and beaten up by the police. And then they heard that one of their number had been killed by police in Houston. So they marched into the city and they did battle with the white folks. And when the battle was over, 16 whites were dead and 4 black soldiers were dead. And immediately, court-martial was convened. 19 black soldiers were sentenced to death. 13 were executed almost immediately, and within a year, about 6 more were hanged by President Woodrow Wilson. This is how the United States begins World War I. It's participation in World War I by showing that its eagerness to carry out capital punishment against black soldiers wholesale. World War I was also a great mobilization in terms of the huge growth in the federal government. The government took over the railroads and expanded exponentially. And that included the intelligence and spying services. And the premier intelligence and spying service was not the FBI, which was very new at that time. It was military intelligence. And military intelligence wanted to open a file on any group of people who might be engaged in what they considered to be subversive activities. So, of course, they had files, and they spied on and harassed and sometimes jailed anti-war protesters, of course, but also union activists, of course. But black people, as black people, were wholesale spied upon by military intelligence. Military intelligence wanted to know the name and the political activities, if there were any, of every prominent black, every black whose name was known to other black people. Military intelligence wanted to know. Joel Spingarn, who was the white chairman of the board of the NAACP, they made him a major in military intelligence, and he immediately gave military intelligence the names, the addresses, and all the information they wanted on everybody who was in the NAACP. They wanted W.E.B. Du Bois to join military intelligence. He clearly wanted the job. He wrote an editorial called Closing Ranks, which urged Negroes to close ranks around the national defense. And we don't have a problem as long as there's this war going on in Europe. We got no problem with this government. So he was obviously kissing up and showing that he was a friendly element. They offered him a captaincy in military intelligence. But since the white boy, Joel Spingarn, was a major, Du Bois tried to hold out. And finally, they didn't hire him at all. And in fact, they put him on the list and they spied on him for the rest of his life. They spied on Jack Johnson, the heavyweight champion. He was in Mexico, and a store refused to serve him in Mexico City. But Jack Johnson was very popular. Mexicans like boxing. And so some Mexican generals intervened and made the store owner apologize to Jack Johnson. Now, that's a nice little story. You're saying, why is Glenn telling that story about Jack Johnson? Well, the Americans were very, very upset, because they thought that that meant that black people were going to side with the Mexicans in a war. See, because they had invaded Mexico not only a few years before, and were contemplating doing so again. And so just Jack Johnson getting complimented by Mexican generals put a scare into him. Oh, they're going to side with the enemy again. Mm-hmm. Attorney General Palmer, you heard his name from the Palmer Red Raids. He tried to shut down W.E.B. Du Bois' NAACP magazine, The Crisis. He tried to shut down E. Philip Randolph's magazine, The Messenger. He certainly tried to shut down the African Blood Brotherhood's magazine, The Crusader. And they designated A. Philip Randolph as the most dangerous Negro in the country. And this was 20 years before his threat to do a march on Washington in 1941. It was enough that he favored unions and put out a newspaper. And in fact, the Justice Department monitored every single black newspaper in the country. It did not monitor every paper in the country, but every black newspaper in the country, because, well, we are a national security threat. All of you know that Martin Luther King was spied on, and much worse. But you might not know that his grandfather was spied on. Martin Luther King's grandfather was also a pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church. He was the first president of the Atlanta NAACP. So he was spied on, and they put a dossier together on him in military intelligence. And then Martin Luther King's father, Daddy King, he was spied on because he had done some work with the National Negro Congress, which first came to great fame with the Scottsboro Boys case. And the National Negro Congress was thought to be too heavily influenced by communists. So Dr. Martin Luther King is only the third in the line of those pastors of the Ebenezer Baptist Church who have been spied upon by the United States government, by military intelligence. Martin Luther King's, I'm talking about Junior, his army intelligence file was opened up in 1947 when he was a teenage student at Morehouse College, because he showed up in a group photo with other teenagers, teenage students, and a white woman who was suspected of being a communist. And in 1947, he was 18 or 19 years old. Rosa Parks was on the list of the Army intelligence before she ever sat down on that bus in Montgomery, because she had trained at the Highlander School in Tennessee, and Army intelligence had been looking at the Highlander School since 1940. When Martin Luther King was organizing in Birmingham in 1963, the U.S. military flew a U-2 spy plane over Birmingham to take pictures as if it was Havana or Moscow. Between 1963 and 1970, they made at least seven U-2 spy flights over American cities, looking for ways to combat black rebellion. After the Detroit Rebellion of 1967, the U.S. Army's Psychological Warfare Division questioned about 500 black men who had been arrested during the rebellion. They wanted to know one they asked one question, and that was who these men thought was the most effective black leader in the country. And a vast majority said Dr. King. I don't know if that did Dr. King any good. Before Martin Luther King was assassinated, the U.S. Army, you see, I'm focusing here not on the FBI, but on U.S. military intelligence, because then we know we're really talking about national security. Before he was assassinated, the U.S. Army had mapped 124 American cities for counterinsurgency purposes, and they were in, that is, the U.S. military and National Guard were in many of those cities, of course, right after he was killed. In fact, when I was in the Army, the day that Dr. King was killed, we were out in the field in North Carolina, and all the officers were looking at maps of Washington, D.C., where we would be in 2 days. The Army was mapping all of the what they called sensitive areas of the cities. They had laid out sites for landing zones, places where that they could secretly store weapons and riot gear. They were basically making preparations for war. And that's what you do when you're facing a national security threat, a national security threat being all of us. I'm not going to go into depth on COINTELPRO, as I said at the very beginning, because everybody in this room is familiar with COINTELPRO. There are former political prisoners in this room, and there's the wife of a political prisoner. I am going to mention that the FBI paid more than 7,000 informers to infiltrate black organizations in the 1960s. 7,000. That is more than the estimated membership of the Black Panther Party at its height. This represented a total mobilization for the suppression of black political activity under national security grounds. Possibly the most frightening national security issue was within the military. I'm talking about from the U.S. state's standpoint, was within the U.S. military itself. Up to 1965, blacks did take disproportionate casualties in Vietnam. After 1965 and this huge surge in black draft numbers, the black body count went proportionately down, even though far more blacks were coming into the army. The reason is that blacks decided that they would not allow themselves to become cannon fodder, and the army understood that it had lost control of its troops. Brother Kay Fing probably has told some of you about how the black soldiers at Pleiku, they attempted to disarm them after Martin Luther King was killed. In jails like Long Binh in Vietnam, they were overflowing with black soldiers. There were pitched battles in Da Nang and other places between black soldiers, and I mean in large numbers, and the military police. There was a war going on in Vietnam, and the commanders could not achieve their objectives. People would not go from place A to place B if they thought it was too dangerous. And this resulted, I believe, that this had more of an effect on the U.S. withdrawal from Vietnam, and especially on the creation of the all-volunteer army, than the demonstrations at home. Because what is a general going to do if he can't even move his troops around? The United States Army had virtually collapsed. My division was the 82nd Airborne Division. It was 60% black. After the introduction of the all-volunteer army, we saw a kind of social engineering, a concerted effort to get black folks out of these elite and combat units, because they could not be trusted to do what they were told. And so today, my division, which had been 60% black in the Vietnam era, is now the whitest division in the Army. That was because we did not cooperate with them. And then, beginning around 1970, we enter the era of mass black incarceration as we now know it. It begins with hyper-surveillance of black America and the total militarization of the police forces. Mass black incarceration is not based on any overt manifestation of black political dissent. It operates independent of that. It does not require proof of any specific black threat to national security, because it has already been concluded that blacks are, as a people, an abiding threat to the rulers of the United States. This requires a constant counterinsurgency, even when there is no insurgency. And that is the character of what they do. What I've tried to outline this morning is that there is nothing new, nothing recent about the prevailing view among America's rulers that blacks are a national security threat. It is older than the nation itself. Black mass incarceration is now the defining characteristic of the United States as a country. African Americans make up 1 out of 8 of all of the world's prisoners, and this obtains regardless of the crime rates in the United States. Hyper-surveillance of blacks is at the center of that system. We are the primary targets of the national security state. We hear folks on the left talk about the national security state all the time, and often it's done in the sense of, oh, now we're all in it together. No. We are the primary targets and have always been so. In recent decades, with U.S. imperialism in deep and terminal crisis, The rulers of the empire have declared a war against all, except, of course, against those other four or five eyes of the white settler states. But we have to be clear that their war against us predates their current predicament. It is a permanent war. That means that the new high-tech systems of surveillance and disruption should be seen as a kind of overlay, that is, another layer of repression on top of the already existing mechanisms. It means that the NSA's new systems for mapping human networks have specific keys and codes for black people, and you can bet on that. You can take that as a given. We have always been the special enemy of the American state. And there have always been Negroes who say that we do not warrant this special treatment, that we are not a danger to the white supremacist capitalist empire. But they are wrong. We are dangerous to imperialism. And we're going to get more dangerous. Because we and other struggling peoples of the world represent a fatal threat to the rule of the white rich and their henchmen. We should hope that we will live up to our historical status as enemies of empire and wear it like a badge. Power to the people.
Guru, it's a great presentation by Mr. Ford. Let's all of us give Mr. Ford a round of applause again. We have a party-to-party salute, which is going to be done by Comrade Fente Toli. He lives in Sierra Leone, West Africa, and works as a teacher. He joined the Yuhu movement in 2010 and was the organizing secretary. He's now the chairman of the African People's Socialist Party, Sierra Leone. Please welcome Fente Toli.
Uhuru. Actually, I thought I was to come up here and make my own solidarity statement, but to give my own salute, I think, you know, I can also do so. African People's Socialist Party, APSP, salutes the African People's Socialist Party, USA, for their hard work to make the 6th Congress a remarkable event of 2013. Special thanks and appreciation goes to the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party, Chairman Nomali Yashitela, for his tremendous and courageous works, for providing a reliable leadership for the unification and liberation of Africa and its masses. From the brutal colonial imperialism and capitalism relationship that exists between the oppressor nation and the oppressed nation. Bravo to the deputy chairwoman, Ona Yesitela, who has demonstrated the true value of what African women are capable of doing. May you live longer till the end of the struggle. I say bravo to the National Central Committee of the African People's Socialist Party, USA, for your brave fight. You are indeed great warriors of Africa and a force for good. You are more than 1,000 soldiers at war with our greatest enemies. I say keep the fight going. The APSP Sierra Leone would not hesitate to climb mountains and to swim across oceans to stand by you at all times of the struggle. Long live Africa, long live APSP. Church one, Uhuru.
Sure, I've been powerful. Brothers and sisters, we have a solidarity statement from the People's Organization for Progress in New York, New Jersey. It comes from their leader, Larry Adams. One of their leaders, Larry Adams, he's the vice chair of the People's Organization for Progress in New York, New Jersey. The People's Organization for Progress is an organization of tireless fighters for justice for African people on every front. The statement reads as follows. To Chairman Omali Yeshitela and the African People's Socialist Party, statement of solidarity from the People's Organization for Progress to the 6th Congress of the African People's Socialist Party. Sisters and brothers, comrades in struggle of the African People's Socialist Party. The People's Organization for Progress extends warm and sincere feelings and solidarity to you on the occasion of your 6th Congress. That you have politically and organizationally consolidated step by step, year by year, through a process that reflects 5 congresses of growth and development of advanced forces in the struggle for the liberation of African peoples and the defeat of the system of world imperialism led by U.S. imperialism and thereby contributing to the emancipation of all humankind from our history of exploitation and oppression is testament to the serious consistency and commitment of APSP leadership and cadre and followers to forge a weapon of liberation. Your experience provides an inspirational example for emulation by POP, and forces for black liberation and the defeat of imperialism. In the current situation of imperialist crisis, characterized by intensification of attacks and oppression and exploitation of oppressed people and the international working class, politics of impoverishment and disempowerment of the masses of the sons and daughters of Africa and our allies, and wars for plunder of material resources and enslavement of our labor. The organization of struggle and resistance is the historic task of the day. You recognize the situation and are risking and are rising to the task. We join you in this endeavor. We too are committed to, through struggle, develop the consciousness and organization of our people for day-to-day struggle and ultimate liberation. We have unity on our particular responsibility as oppressed daughters and sons of tormented Africa in the belly of the beast that leads world oppression and exploitation to expose, struggle against, and defeat our own ruling class and stand with denigrated black humanity and the peoples of the world who struggle for freedom and full realization of our potential. We will together oppose the enemies of black people and all creators of wealth, regardless of the color or ethnicity of the servants of imperialism. We will not let anything distract us from our march to liberation. We will judge political actors by their deeds and substance, not words and appearances. Comrades, march on. We march with you on the long road to freedom and justice. Uhuru, Larry Adams, Vice Chair, External Affairs for the People's Organization for Progress. Next on our program today is a very important presentation entitled The Theory of African Internationalism, which will be presented by the chairman of the African People's Socialist Party and the African Socialist International, Omali Yeshitela. I want to rule my destiny.
I wanted to just really share my appreciation for all of the solidarity statements that we've just heard, and really for the presentation that was just made by Comrade Glenn Ford. I thought it was especially powerful, and I'm reminded, of course, it validates everything that we understand about our relationship to capitalism, to imperialism, to America itself. And as he was talking, I was thinking about the creation of the SWAT organizations, the SWAT teams, that even though they're special weapons and tactics organizations, much of what they do has been generalized throughout police departments as a part of the regular practice, but they still have these special teams. And this was something that really was initiated in California, in Los Angeles, by Daryl Gates. And the first SWAT raid that happened in this country happened in Los Angeles in 1972. And the target was the Black Panther Party. And I think it's really important to understand that, because you see SWAT and they have, you know, these dramas on television and movies made by them, you know, often starring Negroes like Samuel L. Jackson and what have you. But it was an organization and a form of military organization and aggression against that was designed to target African people. I think it's also worth mentioning that I really appreciated Glenn giving a lot of the history as it represented itself in certain incidents and time frames in this country. But it is logical what he said clearly, because you cannot capture a population. He talks about how that manifests itself in this country, but the imperialist, the capitalist state, right? The state is this entity that is necessary when you have societies that's based on that's split between haves and have-nots, and those who have mostly get it as a consequence of expropriating or taking value and stuff from those who don't have it. Well, people don't just gonna say, "Okay, wow, he took it," and you know, let's be cool about it. What people do when they can, they try to take their stuff back. You know, they even if they don't know that they're dealing sometime with this unfair relationship, they know somehow those guys got it over there. You know, hard as my mama worked and everybody else, we ain't got nothing. So sometimes it's in the form of, you know, a little white lady with a purse being snatched, or sometimes. But the point is that people will always try to get it back. They will not easily handle this, and certainly you got a whole world economy that gets created and forged off an attack on an Africa and dispersal of African people, who then go create value everywhere else we are, that goes to creating this whole empire, this whole European entity on other people's land and stuff like that. In order for that to work, you got to have some kind of organization, a special organization that's there to keep those people from whom everything is being stolen from trying to get it back or hurting the ones who stole it from them. And there are not enough, what do you call them, safe? What kind of bars do you call those things that you put up in your house? Security bars, yeah, in the world to keep that from happening. But so states have existed in history since the manifestation of societies being divided in what you might call class. And but the thing that's really striking is about the emergence of the capitalist state. The capitalist state was born as an imperialist state from its inception. It was a state that was born through stealing lands from the indigenous people, from the attack on Africa, from the wars that was made against China, the Opium War, etc. It has always been had this capacity to reach out and control the world. It's the capitalist state that is being extended into what we call neo-colonial countries today. That's the capitalist state. That's the imperialist state. That's and sometimes it's stronger or weaker depending on what the circumstances are in a particular place. So it is logical that you would have what Comrade Glenn Ford is talking about. The whole world is a threat. And the Haitian Revolution almost overturned the capitalist system. Now think about this, because the whole world at that time, the economy of the world was organized around slavery. The whole economy of the world was organized around slavery. And you have this handful of incredible, magnificent African forces who rose up for the first successful slave revolt in history. The first successful workers' revolution in the world, right there, Haitian, African people, handful of people, you know, who made that struggle. And not only made that struggle, which was important and significant enough unto itself, but who, having made this struggle, declared that any slave on earth, you come to Haiti and you're free. Any slave on earth, that challenged the entire world capitalist system itself. I mean, Napoleon's best troops, led by his brother-in-law, came to Haiti and they wiped their asses out. You know, and you have to have this horrible kind of organization that has as a special function to suppress those people who would try to take back their resources. Nobody's going to just sit down for this. That's why the drones are there. That's why aggression is being made against all the peoples around the world. And so, you know, Glenn's, that was a really, really helpful presentation in terms of, you know, like all that information that you just put forward, it's really helpful. Because like you said, it's not obvious. It's not something that's easily available. I appreciate that. And I appreciate everybody who's ever fought against this imperialist, this empire. And it's a natural instinct. And what is unnatural is the Sharptons and the Jacksons and all these other folk. It is unnatural. Marcus Garvey was a natural. Marcus Garvey was natural. Was a natural manifestation. Everybody wants to be free. And freedom, you know, this whole concept of being free with the so-called Emancipation Proclamation. The whole concept, first of all, is fallacious for 1,000 different reasons. Some of them were suggested by Comrade Glenn Ford. But how can you have in captivity a whole group of people on one day, right? And the next day say you are free, but you are now citizens of the United States. As phony as the citizenship was. Right? How in the hell can you be, how can I be free and then you tell me I'm a citizen of the oppressor's entity? If I'm free, it's up to me what the hell I'm going to be and where I'm going to be and the rest of that. You understand? You don't say you're free, now you're a citizen. And then act like they did me a favor. Please. But let's talk, because we're talking about revolution. And I really want to put that, make sure that we are focused on this notion that in order for us to be free, a recognition of the problem is not good enough. Being angry about what happened to us is not good enough. We are going to have to overturn this relationship. We're going to have to fight for power. This man, making the white man like us, being accepted by America, that stuff is not going to do it. What's going to have to happen is we're going to have to fight for power. There are all kinds of people right now in more some kind of action or another in this country all the time. But the final question that we have to ask is toward what end? Is it enough just to be in motion? Is that all it takes? And we say it takes more than that. It takes revolution. It takes a struggle for power. We have to overturn this relationship we have with the oppressor, because this oppressor brings nothing but death and destruction. Imperialism, capitalism brings nothing but death and misery and destruction. It brings humiliation. And every conscious African person ought to be humiliated living under these conditions. Here we are. You know, should recognize ourselves as a free people who refuse to live under this kind of submission. In order for that to happen, we have to have revolution. In order for revolution to happen, we have to have organization. And that organization has to be informed by advanced revolutionary theory. It must be about trying to overturn this relationship, because it ain't going to happen accidentally. And regardless of what Reverend Chicken Bone say, we are not going to be able to pray our way out of here. And yet it's not even complicated. All we got to do is look at what it took to put us in this situation. That's what's going to take to get us out of this situation. And if you can find any place in history that we voted our way in here, then I say run to the polls. But it didn't happen that way, and we're not going to get out of here that way. So this discussion, you know, is talking about science. This political report is we really struggle to try to bring a scientific understanding of the world, a scientific understanding of our place and destiny in this world. Sum it up, and let this be the foundation, the basis of how we create all kinds of policies and tactics and strategies in terms of winning our freedom. So we say that the science of African internationalism helped our party avoid the ideological traps. And we're not going to be able to read all of this. We're going to talk about some of it and read some of it, and hopefully we can make our way through this. But I'm really, you know, just as I said, relieved to have recognized that most people have read the political report anyway. And but the science of African internationalism helped our party avoid the ideological traps that serve to validate the assumptions of the superiority of white people and divert us from the mission of a united African people led by our working class, capturing power and uniting Africa and our nation. Our party brought science to our defeated African liberation movement at a time when it was generally bogged down in racial and cultural nationalism that indulged in candle-lit ceremonies, religious obscurantism, and a nostalgia for an often imaginary African past. We were able to discover the material basis for the exploitation, exploitation and oppression of Africans and others in this world. With African internationalism, we can understand the material forces at work in the movement of history. We can clearly see the current shift in the balance of power between the oppressed and the oppressor, between Europe and the rest of us, between the so-called white man and the so-called black man. We see this balance, this shift in the balance of forces happening right before our very eyes. We determined long ago that characterizing our movement as a struggle against racism was a self-defeating waste of time. What is called racism is simply the ideological foundation of capitalist imperialism. Rather than defining the system of our oppression, racism is a concept that denies Africans our national identity and dignity. It relegates us to the Sisyphean task of winning acceptance from and sometimes often becoming one with our oppressors. With African internationalism, we have proven that race is simply a colonial invention originating from the enslavement and colonization of Africans and Africa that gave birth to capitalism and simultaneously the European nation. Our struggle has always been one for power, not against racism, as we have shown. To the extent that we win power, the racism of others is irrelevant. Power is the great equalizer, the fundamental aphrodisiac that is capable of turning a racist of today into a fawning sycophant of tomorrow. The struggle against racism is a struggle of the petty bourgeoisie fighting to integrate into the white capitalist world, to board the sinking ship of white power. It is a diversionary struggle, reliant on failed philosophical assumptions that must be cast aside as a precondition for moving forward. This is not an innocent issue of semantics. The way this is understood informs our practice. The struggle against racism presupposes one approach and the struggle against imperialist colonialism another. We are not a race but a nation of people scattered across the globe. We have been pushed out of history by our imperialist oppressors, partially through the concept of race. Our national homeland has been occupied in various ways for millennia. Our people have been captured and forcibly dispersed around the world. Our labor and land have been violently extracted to build the European nation and world capitalist system that determine our reality and the contours of the struggle in which we have been engaged for more than 500 years. The fight against AFRICOM cannot be characterized as a struggle against racism. any more than the liberation of our people in Haiti or the necessary unification of Africa to stop the rape of our motherland and the theft of its resources. The material conditions Africa suffer worldwide have their origin in the attack on Africa. That the material conditions that we suffer everywhere. Why is it that everywhere we look, Africans face the conditions that we do? Whether it's in Stockholm, whether it's in Paris, whether it's in Berlin, whether it's in Ghana, or whether it's in the Bahamas or in the Fifth Ward of Houston, Texas. Our condition is the same, and it has its origin in the attack on Africa. It has been extended. The attack on Africa and our oppression, the theft of our homeland, our poverty, our misery, it's an extension of Africa that has been spread around the world. Our poverty and susceptibility to ignorance, violence, and material want throughout the world, including in the U.S., the United Kingdom, and the rest of Europe, result from the material conditions in existence in Africa since its capture and partition. Are the Iraqis and Afghans fighting against racism? What about the people of South America and the Caribbean? Certainly, the bourgeois ideology of racism serves to unite the vast majority of whites and even some Africans in support of the imperialist agenda. Increasingly, though, this ideology is running up against the material reality of a global power shift where the oppressed are clearly the locomotive of history. More and more, whites are themselves running from their own so-called racial designation. We've talked about Patrick Buchanan again. His worldview is informed by assumptions of white superiority that we recognize as racism. And he himself is alarmed by the growing evidence that shifting power relations are chasing whites away from solidarity with their so-called racial identity. Apparently, this phenomenon has achieved such significance that Buchanan has conceptualized it as ethno-masochism. In his book, Suicide of a Superpower, Buchanan laments, and I'm quoting him now, questions about the future arise. If the end of white America is a cultural and demographic inevitability, what will the new mainstream of America look like? And what ideas and values might it rally around? What will it mean to be white after whiteness no longer defines the mainstream? Will anyone mourn the end of white America? Will anyone try to preserve it? One reaction he's quoting now, Professor Zhu, cultural elites, some are shedding their white identity. If white America is losing control and the future will belong to people who can successfully navigate a post-white multicultural landscape, then it is no surprise that many white Americans are eager to divest themselves of their whiteness entirely. This is the quote who he's quoting. And then he says, the day after Obama's inaugural, television host Larry King blurted out to an uneasy Bob Woodward a secret desire of his son. He quotes his son as saying, my younger son, Cannon, is 8. And he now says that he would like to be black. I'm not kidding. He said, there's a lot of advantages. Black is in. Is this a turning of the tide? This is Buchanan who is talking about this. And he's frantic. And indeed, black is in. The tide has turned. Black is the future. Not because of some defeat of racism, but because Africans are a part of the dispossessed, the wretched of the earth, that are overturning a world social system whose ideological foundation is racism. This system is no longer able to withstand the tide of history sweeping all forms of capitalist parasitism into the proverbial dustbin of history. The anti-racists would have us fight for a place in a dying system. They would have us objectively uniting with our oppressors. Anti-racists would transform us into house Negroes fighting to save the master's burning house, to paraphrase Malcolm X. The essential question is parasitism. Up to now, Since the successful rise of imperialism, Europe and white people have been the subject, and Africans and others have been objects of what can only be described as imperialist history for the past 500 years. We have been voiceless and reduced to invisibility and stature and significance. Karl Marx characterized the slavery, rape, pillage, and genocide associated with the emergence of white power and our current status as primitive accumulation. In another instance, he referred to slavery as an economic category of the greatest importance. This is Marx. In the political report to the Fifth Congress, to the party, I commented on what that meant. And a quote from the Fifth Congress political report. Here, the relationship between peoples and countries is also obscured and mystified. Marx attributes European development solely to the genius and productive forces inside of Europe. He is therefore thereby covering up or liquidating the fact that this so-called development for Europe requires the parasitic impairment of the capacity of independent development in Africa and other places victimized by Europe. In another place in the political report, this rhetorical question was raised. Would capitalism and the resultant European wealth and African impoverishment have occurred without the European attack on Africa, its division, African slavery and dispersal, colonialism and neocolonialism? And the answer is obvious to anyone with even a smattering of historical knowledge, but Marx didn't get it. Most of our movement still doesn't get it. Revolutionaries around the world have missed this crucial understanding of the foundation of imperialist existence. The most erudite practitioners of the superstition called capitalist economics don't get it. This is one of the reasons nothing they say about the extant economic crisis of the imperialist world makes any sense. I mean, you got all these professors on TV, you know, pundits all the time, you know, it's, you know, professoralizing, you know, about the situation, and they don't get it. And everybody's saying, oh, we're so surprised. We never thought something like this could happen. Hell, I knew it was going to happen. And you know, we're talking about it for a while now. And they don't get it because we are invisible in a certain way. Our summation of this imperialist dilemma is reflected in this quote from the Fifth Congress Political Report. The North Americans, like most Europeans, assume they have some idea of the basis of the contradictions because of the fantasies passed on to them historically about the source of their comparative wealth and so-called good fortune. Nevertheless, those are resources stolen from others that have become increasingly difficult for them to afford in their malls and supermarkets. It is somebody else's oil wrenched from the earth with bloody consequences for which they now have to pay more. The bauxite, coltan, gold, and diamonds, along with the cocoa beans, cotton, and cheaply produced clothing have cost the rest of us dearly. And our combined struggles to seize control of our lives and resources are affecting the ability of North Americans and other Europeans to enjoy a parasitic economy that requires global misery for an oasis of white happiness. That's unquote. The inconsistent materialism of Buchanan and Brzezinski, quoted earlier, allows them to recognize some relationship between the decline of imperialism and the rise of formerly subject peoples. Like the imperialist economists, however, they are blinded by philosophical idealism, the assumptions of white superiority that will not allow them to see the dialectic between Western or white success and African impoverishment. They can't see it. And so that's why they can't get to it. They can't understand what the hell is happening. You know, and what we see, hear from them, from the Buchanans, from the Brzezinskis, from all of the so-called thinking representatives of white power trying to explain the economic crisis is simply an ideological reflection of a social system in dire distress because it rests upon a material basis of the expropriation of value and wealth from the oppressed peoples around the world. That's why there's so much hysteria about the border now here in this country and immigrants in Europe and every place else. That's why Afghanistan is under attack, where people cannot even afford enough bread for their babies every day because the social system is in a state of severe crisis, but they cannot see us. They don't even factor us Even Marx talked about the uncivilized people when they coming up with certain kind of analysis. And I'm somebody who respect the brilliance of Karl Marx and in a lot of different ways. But they didn't get it. We do. So we say that, like the imperialist economists, however, they are blinded by philosophical idealism, the assumptions of white superiority that will not allow them to see this dialectic between Western or white success and African impoverishment. They cannot accept that the changing relations of power are exposing the real dependency, the dependency of the colonizer upon the colonized, and of whites on Africans. This is as true of the capitalism of Adam Smith as it is of the capitalism of Karl Marx. Wage labor, commodity production, private ownership and control of the means of production are features of capitalism. This is something that most people who are aware of capitalism, who would describe and define capitalism, they would talk about it as being characterized by wage labor, commodity production, private ownership and control of the means of production. But what they do not understand and what does never effectively come into the equations is that wage labor, commodity production, private ownership, and control of the means of production are features of capitalism that function on a foundation of parasitism, or what Marx referred to as primitive accumulation, that Marx correctly identified as the equivalent of original sin. Isn't that something? The equivalent of original sin. You would say, well, damn, if he said this is the equivalent of original sin, then that has to be central, it seems to me, to really understanding what capitalism is and how it functions and what it is about. But there's a certain invisibility that even as he makes the statement that he cannot recognize the foundation has been the critical component. This is the DNA. This is the starting point of capitalist accumulation and production and of the capitalist system itself. Well, this is not to say that everything that Marx said was wrong, but it is to say that everything he said must be reevaluated based on a materialist appreciation of the centrality of capitalist parasitism, what he called primitive accumulation. Otherwise, we will continue to be duped by those who verbally claim to oppose capitalism, but who cannot oppose parasitic capitalism, which is the relationship that the whole white world and capitalist forces has with the rest of us. We are not Marxists. We are historical materialists. We have taken the historical materialism of Marx, the science of investigating and analyzing society, to investigate and analyze our reality as Africans. Our findings prove that we are a part of the so-called primitive accumulation that was mentioned by Karl Marx in his works. Malcolm X, a materialist of sorts in his own right, has been quoted as saying that a person watching somebody sitting on a hot stove would describe the experience differently from the person actually sitting on the stove, right? And this is true. The spectator is not required to have a full understanding of the experience. The spectator is not required to have a full understanding of the experience. The victim of the hot stove is provoked by his reality. It becomes a historical necessity to understand the question. Using the collective experience of African people as a starting point, we were able to use the science of dialectical and historical materialism, cleansing it of its Marxist metaphysics and idealism, to investigate and analyze our relationship to the world. For us, the rise of capitalism in the world is not based on some purely abstract Marxist theory about the development of human society. It is not a theoretical question. What is called primitive accumulation is not a theory. The rape of Africa, the enslavement of our continent and our people, the forcible dispersal of Africans throughout the world as a means of rescuing Europe from disease and poverty, the process that gave rise to capitalism, is a matter of historical record. Marx, the spectator, did not have to understand this. The person sitting on the hot stove, the living, breathing, thinking, so-called primitive accumulation, would either understand this question or perish. We chose to understand. More than that, we chose to develop a worldview stemming from this understanding. This is the origin of African internationalism. African internationalism is simply an investigation. It's simply the worldview stemming from a historical materialist investigation and analysis of the world, with the starting point being the experience and role of Africans and Africa in the advent of capitalist imperialism as the rise of white power. That's all it is. Parasitic capitalism is the real issue. It is this reality that ultimately distinguishes African internationalist socialism from the struggle for white rights that usually characterize most movements of Europeans worldwide. It is the difference in socialism resulting from overturning the pedestal upon which all capitalist activity occurs and some variation of the national socialism achieved by the infamous Nazis of Germany. The final analysis, that's all it is, national socialism, if it's not a socialism that they're talking about that gets rid of the pedestal upon which the whole damn thing rests. How can you come up with the assumption that somehow central to the existence of capitalism is slavery, as has been done here, and then say the way you get rid of slavery, of capitalism, is the white workers, industrial workers, coming, overthrowing the white bourgeoisie, all of which rests on my enslavement. It doesn't make any sense at all, does it? I don't think so, anyway. In the past few years, the crisis of imperialism has thrust a number of North Americans and Europeans into motion, from Tea Partiers and Wall Street occupiers in the U.S. to thousands of militants in Greece, Spain, Brazil, and other countries. White people have been mobilized by the inability of capitalism to live up to their expectations. They are demanding to be restored to their rightful place atop the pedestal of capitalist prosperity, sharing in the stolen loot of colonial plunder. That's why Lynn Stewart is in prison. You know, because she broke the mold. She's supposed to be the white person. What she's supposed to be doing is fighting to get a better place on the damn pedestal and not joining with the damn people who are trying to tear the pedestal down. That's why she's dying in prison right now. The problem is that this can only happen at the expense of the well-being of the historical victims of capitalist prosperity, the subject and colonial peoples in the world, whose exploited labor and resources create the pedestal upon which all white people sit. Europe's economic uncertainty has been brought about by oppressed peoples who are currently fomenting the crisis with our struggles for the recapture of our resources, our sovereignty, dignity, and our history. It is an error to assume that primitive accumulation is dead history, something that has happened a long time ago with no implications for today. The truth is that today's capitalist imperialist structures, the ones being challenged in a thousand different ways, are structures that originated in the very genesis of capitalism as it emerged through the assault on Africa and the majority of humanity from the primordial sludge of backward and disease-ridden Europe. It's the same damn structures. Nothing went away. They are shakier today. These understandings of African internationalism require action. They are not for consumers of information. Our party's theory is the only body of political understanding that can make sense of what is happening in the world today. Our African internationalist theoretical contributions serve to break the shackles historically imposed on revolutionary theory as perceived through the lenses of oppressor nation intellectuals whose worldview was determined by their existence on the pedestal of our oppression. African internationalism, for the first time, allows for Africans and the oppressed of the world to become the subjects of history, something that was not possible with the theory of Marx, his contemporaries and followers. Today, the conditions of the real world manifested by the crisis of imperialism are beginning to confirm what African internationalism has so long predicted. And so we're not going to be able to, but I want to just say a few things. Because on page 41, we're saying that seeing the world as it is, not as we wish it were. That's really important to try to. How am I doing? I don't have much time. I'd like to, you know, to, I think you call them analogies and things like that, to use them. But it's really important. It's not just empty words. To see the world as it is. To really understand the world as it is. Because you can, you know, everybody wants happiness. Everybody. I don't know any human being that doesn't want happiness. Doesn't want everybody to get along together and be friends and stuff. You know, Rodney King. You know what I mean? Can we all just get along together? You know, I mean, everybody wants that. But wanting that and having that kind of world is are two different things. And I think that we can fight for that. We must desire and fight for it, but you can't fight for it unless the starting point of that, of how we get there, is really looked at. You can say, I want to be happy, therefore, you know, I want slavery to be over, therefore, you know, you have to say, what put us here and what will it take to get us out of this situation? You must do that. That's absolutely necessary. So African people, and we have a really complicated kind of contradiction. I'm trying to see where we deal with this because one of the serious contradictions, and maybe we'll talk about it a little bit, I don't remember, is this contradiction between white people and Africans and other people around the world. Because our relationship with white people has become really mysterious. And it's become mysterious in many ways because our relationship with white people has been something that has been characterized by inhumanity. But just the worst kind of bestiality, oppression. I mean, it's just hard to even, you know, I mean, you can't even as much as I know about this thing in history, you know, you're subject to forget that this kind of stuff actually happened because it's just almost unfathomable. You know, stuff that was done to the indigenous people here. You know, to capture, you know, women and cut out their vaginas and use them for saddle, to wrap around the saddle horns or to cut out their wombs. You know, and make hat bands out of that, and I mean to you know rape 10-year-old babies and stuff like that, which was a common practice to train dogs that would eviscerate human beings, to train them to tear the guts out, which is what the Europeans brought to this continent to and where there were no horses, so don't have a horse, just jump on the back of a so-called Indian and ride the person to where you want to go. That is the reality of this damn relationship. It is horrible. To capture African people, to capture an African man in this country and to cut off his penis and make him eat it while he's dying and alive. This kind of stuff is, you know, you can't even fathom the kinds of horror and terror that's been imposed on Africa and the rest of the world by white people. And this has contributed to a kind of mystery about white people, you know, that, you know, there are people who make their living running around saying like, you know, the white people are really... you know, mutations, you know, they're not really human beings, they're mutations, or the white man is the devil, you know, and all of which makes sense, you know, in a certain way. I mean, this mystery that's associated with white people for us. But we say that there is a way to understand this question that gets devoid of superstition and the rest of it. And that's really what's important for us, because African internationalism, to be a real theory, to be really meaningful, cannot just simply explain black people in the world. I mean, what kind of theory is that? I mean, like we live in some kind of vacuum because there are black people, like some. No. African internationalism explains the world and our place in it. It doesn't just explain us, it explains the whole world and our place in it. That's the only way it will make sense. And it makes the assumption that there is something common about human behavior. There are certain common motivating forces, factors, that's necessary for human beings. And anyway, so we say that African people, like all humanity, have always been motivated by the struggle to understand our place and destiny in the world. We, like others, have, through our collective life experiences, been compelled to find answers to the fundamental philosophical questions revolving around the primacy of spiritual versus the material world. What is the basis of our oppression? Can the answer be found in religious scripture? And, you know, some people say, well, we say investigate the world. You know, you got a problem in the world, investigate the damn world. Don't send me to St. Luke chapter such and such and thing. I want to investigate the damn world. You understand? That's what you want to do if you want to understand the world. You know? If you want to understand the Bible, investigate the Bible. If you understand the world, investigate the damn world. Right? So what is the basis of our oppression? Can the answer be found in religious scripture? Reverend Chickenbone will tell you yes every time. Because he relies on your paycheck. He relies on your love offerings. He relies on your giving money to the pastor for the pastor's anniversary. And his birthday, and his wife's birthday, and her anniversary, and his children's college fund, and the building fund, and every other thing else. So you must believe that the answer is in scripture that only he can interpret correctly. Are we oppressed because we have offended the gods, or perhaps sought solace from the wrong gods? You've seen this. You see, the black nationalists today say, well, our problem is we've been worshiping the white man's God, right? We should be worshiping our own God, and that's where we went wrong. We went wrong when we got involved in the white man's religion. That's the problem. Please. Are the white colonial oppressors and some of the African petty bourgeoisie correct when they say we are experiencing the consequence of insufficient civilization or inadequate education, or that we are morally depraved? How in the hell can these Negro leaders be talking about moral depravity of African people being responsible for our oppression at the same time they are blessing the missiles that's being used to kill oppressed people in Afghanistan and other places around the world? Those who see the spiritual as primary are philosophical idealists. For them, the idea of reality is greater than the reality itself. For idealists, the real material world is dependent on the spiritual. Philosophical idealists do not look for answers about the nature of the world by examining the world itself. They see the world as the creation of some external force that is incapable of standing up to scientific investigation. This is a ruling class worldview that is funneled into the consciousness of the working masses through the African petty bourgeoisie as well as other petty bourgeois and bourgeois mediums. Philosophical idealism assumes that there are things that humans are incapable or unable to comprehend. It claims that the hand of the mysterious is somehow responsible for what we perceive as reality. During the historical process within which our party developed, philosophical idealism was central to the worldview of the Black Liberation Movement, which relied mainly on religious, moral, and colonial explanations to understand and analyze our situation. African philosophical idealists of that period sought explanations for our conditions of existence and our future in the articulations of great leaders, or simply in the consciousness of the Black Liberation Movement itself. In other words, the idealists accepted the movement and its leaders' own self-definition as primary rather than fundamentally examining the actual material conditions that gave rise to the movement and its leaders. See, Karl Marx was right when he said that you cannot judge a movement by its own consciousness. You can't judge a movement by its own consciousness any more than you can judge an individual by his opinion of himself. We don't do that. You know, when you walk around and say, well, what do you think of yourself? Well, I'm wonderful. That works for me. You can't judge a movement. What you do, and you know this, your mama told you this, that and the Bible tell you this, you judge something by their, what do you say? By their actions. You look at the reality. You examine the reality. You find out what gave rise to this situation. Then you can understand it. You want to understand phenomena, you have to investigate the history and the development of that phenomenon before you can understand. You cannot understand it simply because it shows itself to you and because it has an opinion of itself. That's wonderful. And everybody who thinks that's all right, meet me after this. I guess I'm going to give you some opinions about me. philosophical idealists with which our movement had to contend were the various white liberals, including those who defined themselves as leftists. Many of the white leftists relied on religious and moral explanations for their analysis, attributing our oppression to the flawed character of our oppressors. You've heard this before, that America's just not living up to its great ideals. Understand? And that's the only thing that's wrong. So what you do is you spend the rest of your life trying to get America to live up to its great ideals, right? According to these idealists, our oppressors were people who had strayed from the American or European moral ideal. In this way, the white liberals were not that different from the petty bourgeois leaders of the black liberation movement. White leftist ideological intervention usually represents itself in the paternalistic, condescending tendency to approach the issue of the oppression of African people from a predetermined assumption of the universality of the white experience. This Eurocentric viewpoint shows that the leftists have pretty much the same viewpoint as other whites. Often influenced by Karl Marx, the leftists deny being philosophical idealists. The idealism, nevertheless, is reflected in their demand that Africans, the indigenous of the U.S., and the majority of the world's peoples understand our struggle as objects of European-defined and experienced history. That's what, I don't know if I say this in here or not, but that's what even the concept of primitive accumulation does. When Karl Marx said that, and he mentions other things as being factors of primitive accumulation, but the critical thing, the one that he really understood as being the equivalent original sin in political economy was slavery and the other kinds of aggressions against people outside of Europe. There was a point someplace that I was going to make, but from their perspectives, Africans and others are relegated to the position that it was talking about primitive accumulation. Because, and this was why people have been able to say, who've been influenced by Marx, that capitalism was a progressive development in human society. In human society, not in white world, in human society. And they've said, they've created this, what is often referred to as a Marxist formula for the development of human society, that abstracts from history the existence of what they call primitive communism, and then from primitive communism development to what they call slavery, and they were talking about Kirk Douglas, not us, at that time. Too young to know that, but it's Kirk Douglas and Spartacus and stuff that happened among Europeans. And then they talk about what they refer to as feudalism. And then from feudalism, this mysterious thing happens. It leads to capitalism, but before capitalism, there's this primitive accumulation of capital that goes into the emergence of capitalism. But that's the attack on China, the Opium War, the attack on the people in Vietnam that turned Vietnam into a drug den, literally for more than 100 years controlled by France. That's the attack on the indigenous here. That's the reason primitive accumulation is this country, this territory that we live on today. I mean, this is part of primitive accumulation. It's resulted in the indigenous people being stuck in these concentration camps that they call Indian reservations, or sometimes they call them housing projects, if we're living in barrios and the rest of them. That is what it constitutes primitive accumulation. But this concept of primitive accumulation is not designed to describe phenomenon that happened to us, that's integral to our conditions of existence. The concept of primitive accumulation is designed to explain the development of Europe. Do you understand what I'm just saying? It is something that's designed to show how European development occurred in the world. We are invisible. We become these objects of history that only have significance as it relates to contributing to the development of Europe and white people. You with me on that? And so there's something extraordinarily wrong with that worldview, and that's why they're able to say that capitalism represented progress People tell us that capitalism is responsible for this magnificent leap in production. Never could have happened before. I said, bullshit. How can you say that? And we're talking right now in this discussion, we're talking about the 80% of people on earth living off, trying to live off less than $10 a day. That's not as a consequence of some leap in production. And what has happened is slavery. How many hundreds of millions of black people died through the process of slavery? How many under colonial domination? What about the indigenous people that don't exist anymore? What about all the places where colonialism exists who would have been engaged in production if white people and white power in Europe had not attacked us and enslaved us and put us in this situation? To say that capitalism results in this great leap in production is to assume that only white people would have been producing and the rest of us left to our own would have been some kind of barbarians, which is crazy. It's an insult. That's why science is really important. We have to really get to the root of this question and understand it as it relates to our conditions of existence. Even science is not innocent. Even science is not innocent. A lot of people scared as hell of science because in the hands of Europe, the white people, boy, this has been vicious. It has been. Let's put a little smallpox on these blankets and give them to the Indians. That's science at work. You understand? People talk with a Tuskegee. Tuskegee ain't nothing compared to. Let's do a little science, dropping atomic bombs all over the damn world. That's science. People are scared as hell of science because our own experience with science and what they call development has been in the hand of Europe and white power that manifests itself as capitalism in the world. How I'm doing? Okay. So let me see if I can move a bit more quickly. But you see the significance of, really struggling to have some kind of scientific assessment. Because if you don't, you run in circles. You know what I mean? Even trying to solve problems, you sometimes contribute to your own contradictions. Often influenced by Karl Marx, the leftists deny being philosophical idealists. The idealism, nevertheless, is reflected. And the demand that Africans and the indigenous of the U.S. and the majority of the world's people understand our struggles as objects of European-defined and experienced history. From their perspectives, Africans and others are relegated to the positions of auxiliary forces whose ultimately unhappy destiny, independent of our will, history, and experience, is to facilitate the emergence of the industrial or white working class as a new ruling class in a utopian post-capitalist world. The African People's Socialist Party sprang from the very bowels of the remorseless reality and struggles of our people. As we developed, we were increasingly forced to shed all reliance on religion, other forms of superstition, and the goodwill or moral epiphany of our oppressors. I'm telling you, boy, that's really a great relief. Now just think about this. You're trapped forever. You're trapped in these churches, with these treacherous thugs. I mean, preachers should get honest jobs like selling dope. But somebody would say, well, that's exactly what they do. We say that our struggle to understand our reality, while occasionally encumbered and influenced by the worldview of the educated and upper classes, were rooted in attempts to solve the real problems of the concrete contradictions with which our people are embroiled. We were forced to learn that our preconceived notions, gleaned through colonial civic books, preachers and white liberal friends only help to obscure the real contradictions with which our people are confronted. We came to recognize that we must understand the world just as it is, not as we would wish it to be. So we were forced to become philosophical materialists. Materialism teaches us that the world is tangible, knowable, and can be experienced through the senses. It teaches us that all existing phenomena result from material causes that come into being, develop, and pass away according to the laws of the motion of matter. Materialism informs us that the material world is primary. It is objective reality that exists independently of the mind and will of individuals. It does not require the permission of gods or important persons for its existence. The development of African People's Socialist Party during our historical 41-year trajectory in the midst of intense struggle compelled us to understand that the savage and genocidal brutality inflicted upon our people and the world by Europeans or whites has a material basis. It is not to the will of the gods or simply some moral deficiency on the part of whites. While the humanity of Europeans was clearly open to suspicion, the Nation of Islam, for example, declared the white man to be the devil. The answer to the avaricious motivation of white people was not to be found in an examination of morality, religion, or genetics. Our party and movement were forced to conclude that all humans, including Europeans, are trapped by an absolute necessity to secure and develop the means of subsistence. In other words, the primary motivating factor in human society is the creation and recreation of life. Without life, all other questions, religion, culture, genetics, etc., are moot, meaningless. Indeed, culture is a byproduct of the process of creating and recreating life. Human life itself is a condition for the existence of human genetics. However, the process of Africans creating and recreating life was drastically disrupted and altered by the European attack that resulted in the capture and colonial enslavement of Africa and Africans. It's the process of creating and recreating life for ourselves was absolutely disrupted and altered by the attack on Africa. That's why we talk about 37 years being the lifespan, average lifespan of Africans in Sierra Leone. I mean, you're talking about an Africa from which all human life emerged. This is where human life emerged. And you're talking about somebody only living to be 37 years old on average in Africa where life started. There's something absolutely wrong with that process, isn't there? I think so. This attack by Europeans on Africa also resulted in the imposition of artificial borders that separate the dispersed African nation from our human and material resources and from a meaningful relationship among ourselves and with the peoples of the world. The material and human resources of Africa have gone to satisfy the requirements of life for Europeans at the expense of Africa and Africans. The process of Africans creating and recreating life has not been primarily for Africa and Africans. It has been primarily for Europe and the white world at our expense. The progenitor of world capitalism, the attack on Africa and Africans, along with the European assault on Asia and the Americas, rescued Europe and Europeans from an oppressive, thousand-year-long, disease-ridden, impoverished existence known as feudalism. This was the genesis of the capitalist system as a world economy, created on a base of the enslavement of Africans and others. A scientific analysis of human society required that we take a dialectical approach. We could not see the world as static and ready-made. Society had to be analyzed as a process that is in a constant state of motion, of change and development. There's always something new arising to replace the old, and all social motion occurs in relationship to this process of coming into existence and dying away. Europe's attack on Africa was effectively an attack on Africa, an assault on Africa's ability to create life for itself. The assault has had the effect of pushing Africa and Africans out of history. History being the summation of the ongoing struggle to create and recreate life. Slavery, genocide, and colonialism are the stuff of which capitalism was born. African enslavement was the first capital in the development of capitalism. You heard what I just said? African enslavement was the first capital in the development of capitalism. The prevailing legal system, culture, religion, and general philosophical outlook or worldview constitute the superstructure of capitalism thus conceived. Let me go back. Slavery, genocide, and colonialism are the stuff of which capitalism was born. African enslavement was the first capital in the development of capitalism. The prevailing legal system, culture, religion, and general philosophical outlook or worldview constitute the superstructure of capitalism thus conceived. This superstructure is a natural product and reflection of this economic base of colonial slavery. You with me on that? Slavery and colonialism gave rise not only to capitalism, but also to the capitalist and working classes alike of Europe and North America. Slavery and colonialism gave rise not only to capitalism, but also to the capitalist and working classes alike of Europe and North America. The workers and the bourgeoisie, the two primary capitalist defining classes, have occasionally fought great battles with each other since their inception as contending social forces. Nevertheless, both were born and developed on a platform of slavery and colonialism. Consequently, what is often called class struggle inside the U.S. and Europe is actually a contention among the workers and ruling class for control of the parasitic capitalist pedestal and its stolen resources. Yeah. Let me just say that the parasitic foundation, this is it, time is up. The parasitic foundation of world capitalism continues to exist up to now. And somebody said, well, she says time up, why are you still reading? Nobody said that, but that's what I thought. Because deep in my brain, I really am disciplined. I mean, I want to be disciplined. I mean, I believe I'm disciplined, therefore I am disciplined. I tried to be disciplined. Oh, my goodness. Oh, it's analytic. Now she's going to get up and give me the hook. All right, comrades, please, I hope everybody will read and digest and discuss and make struggle whatever necessary with this. I just think that we have to move from this place where we can allow all these charlatans running around to claim themselves to be leaders and who don't know what the hell is going on, having the slightest idea of anything in the world. And we have to create an army of working class intellectuals, you know, working class. And that's why Glenn Ford is here, by the way. Glenn Ford is here because he is one of those examples of people who use empirical data, searching for reality. And he's not liked by some people who, the culturalists and other kinds of people who just want to believe in the boogeyman and stuff like that. And so even though, you know, we may have differences on certain aspects of the thing, but the fact that he is a materialist and he brings material data and he said, this is why I say what I say. And then when he says that, then you can debate him, can't you? Because he said, this is why I say it. This is the reason for it, can't you? You can have the basis for a debate under those circumstances. That, well, in other words, what that simply means to me as a materialist, as somebody who's really trying to investigate like scientific theory, that what he says is falsifiable. You understand? It's falsifiable. He says, this is it. This is why I believe in it. And then you examine it. And then you say, okay, well, if I take this away from what he said, would it still be true? If I put this in, would it still be true? It's falsifiable. When you got somebody said, in the beginning, the word was God, or something to that effect. Now, that's not falsifiable. I mean, well, you know, how am I going? Not yet, it's not anyway. Not yet. And at some juncture, that's going to be falsifiable. In the same way that they used to act like this phony question they'd ask in philosophy questions of, whether you can hear a tree, whether a tree makes a sound when it falls if nobody is there. Well, that sounds really profound. But it's really not that heavy because you can even leave a damn sound-activated tape recorder there now, you know, and make the tree fall. Make sure the tree falls and then, boom, you got a sound. Yes, it made a sound, right? Sometime we're going to be able to say whether that's going to say it's falsifiable at any beginning that was the word and the word was God. You know, and the white guy said it. So, all right, comrade. Victory. Uhuru. I want to rule my destiny. Yeah. I
You hold, comrades. At this time, we would like to open the floor for questions and comments from the audience. There are microphones set up in the aisles. If you have questions or comments, please line up at the microphones. We ask that everyone limit their question or comment to 1 minute so that we can ensure that everyone has the opportunity to participate.
I was scared to stay up here. So, can we open this up for discussion now? Is there someone at the mic? Ah, Brother Ralph.
Yes, brother. Well, thank you so much for this information. First, I have a question.
Okay.
And the question is, when is this information going to be available on tape, on video, that we can buy and disperse it or spread it around the nation?
In many ways, some of it is available now, because even as we're discussing this, if I'm not mistaken, it's being live streamed, is that right? And then being recorded, and this is kind of, sort of, not the best answer yet. And another aspect of it is that we'll be publishing the political report in book form, I think sometime in February. I think that's our goal, to have it published in book form in February. The other thing is that leaving this Congress, we have a responsibility in the party, every place that we're located, is to begin holding discussions, conferences, our entire movements all around the world based on this political report and this kind of discussion. And then beyond that, Comrade Dedan. Comrade Dedan is the guy with the ultimate responsibility for making this stuff happen in terms of, and I know he is in fact working right now on creating DVDs and PowerPoints and other kinds of stuff to, I want you to be able to identify him. Him as the culprit. I want you to know. If it's not out and promptly, this is the culprit here. Don't call me. Call Dedan. Call Tyrone.
You got it. And a comment on the things made. Early on, when there was a Freedom of Information Act, which does not exist, when I got my Freedom of Information Act, I wondered, I says, there are two things I couldn't figure, and that was the military was watching me and the Michigan State Police.
Yep.
And so now a question has been answered by Glenn Ford.
Yeah.
Why the military was watching and making reports.
Yeah.
And that maybe at the next conference he'll come up with why the Michigan State Police are watching.
Yeah.
And I'm from New York. And to concretize the reality of the information that Chairman O'Malley has been giving us about how we have been denied the education, because in the 80s, a woman who was present here at the last conference, Betty Davis,
yes,
who was an honor student from first grade on, for her doctoral thesis, she was writing on the non-self-governing nation of Africans born in America. This was in the 80s.
Yeah.
And guess what?
Yeah.
No university would touch it. Not even the so-called Communist University in New York, the new school, which we was attending. I call them the Rockefeller Communists. The Communists are always on the side of the society. They said there was no such thing. And so we went to Dr. Kenneth Clark, who had just gotten his job at Columbia University. And I said to Ms. Davis, of course he's going to sign on to this. And we went to his office, and he says, Ralph, do you know how long it was for me to get a job? And I'm saying, do I know how long? You know who's fighting in the street to get you the job. And you talk about fear.
Yeah.
The man started to cry.
Yeah.
And to Betty Davis's credit, she says, Ralph, we didn't come here for this. And so let us forget about dissertations and educate the people. The governing, non-self-governing nation of Africans born in America, they knew about it, yeah. But they were making sure that we didn't know. That's Chairman, right. Thank you so much right. for figuring it out.
Thank you.
So we come here to learn, and yeah. I'm learning. I hope everyone else is learning and enjoying as I am.
Uhuru.
Thank you.
Uhuru. Yes. Yes. Uhuru, Comrade Stu.
Uhuru. Can you explain what it means to be a dialectical materialist and a historical materialist, and maybe the difference or...
The difference in the two?
Yeah.
Well, if you understand dialectical materialism, first of all, oh boy, that's a real discussion that you just asked for. Essentially, I did some of that in the presentation I just made in terms of making a distinction between philosophical idealists and philosophical materialists. And that recognize the materialists, that the world is knowable, tangible, that there may be some things that we don't know, but there's nothing that we can't know. And that the world is a place, material reality is something that can be experienced with the senses, with the five senses. You can smell it, touch it, taste it, see it, hear it. That's the material world, and that is primary. And that is the determining factor for everything else, that the ideas that we have are a reflection of the material world that we live in, that we experience. And if there is a severe disagreement between the real world, that is the material world, and our perception of that world, people are often referred to as crazy, right? Because what's in your brain should be a reflection of what's in the world. And that to the extent that there's a great distance between what's in your brain and what's in the world, that's problematic. So materialists are those people who see the primary, material is primary. Now the spiritual world, I talk about spiritual, I'm not talking about spooks and goblins, right, or Halloween past. I'm talking about spiritual stuff, you know, like, although that is part of the issue, can be part of the issue, like a various religion, that's idealism, you know, et cetera. That is a reflection. But when you talk about them, have you ever seen a bumper sticker or something that says, I think, therefore I am? That's an example of philosophical idealism. No, I am, therefore I think.
That's it.
I am, therefore I think. You know, and the other thing is that when we talk about dialectics, we understand, you know, several features of dialectics as opposed to metaphysics. I'm not talking about, many people talk about metaphysics and they think you're talking about religion and superstition. No, but I'm talking about metaphysics as opposed to dialectics. Metaphysics sees the world as static, unchanging, you know, et cetera. Dialectics understand that the world is constantly, everything is in a constant state of transformation, constant state of coming into being and going out of existence. And not only that, but is in some kind of relationship with every other thing. That's dialectics. That's an understanding of dialectics. And historical materialism is simply applying the understanding of dialectical materialism to the investigation and study of social life itself, of society. So I hope that was helpful.
Comrades, we only have time for one more question or comment.
That's a big old brother there, ain't
it? Uhuru, Chairman.
Well, you would have got, they gave a lot of money to get a brother your size, unless you had a machete in your hand that was pointing in their direction.
Probably would have. So, not falling into the trap of becoming what you have characterized as a social media militant, but I remember reading party literature a long time ago saying that party members and people in the movement need to be everywhere,
right.
And certainly in the digital age, that would include the internet, I would assume. How can we effectively take this political report to people through social media?
Yeah. Thank you. I think that's extremely important. And that's part of what the job that Comrade Dedan that I was talking about, that he's really... I know, but I'm saying that I think one way you can do that, I think it would be really important for you to connect with Comrade Dedan and have this discussion about how can we make this happen, because it needs to be out, you know, everywhere. Like, for example, Comrade Wendy Craig has just written her dissertation, a doctoral dissertation that is based on African internationalism. And another comrade who's writing her dissertation now at Howard University is around African internationalism. But this political report must be something that we get widely distributed and read and discussed everywhere around the world. And whatever you can do to contribute to our being able to do that, we want you to do that. Our discussion about social militant militants is not something that is opposed to the internet. That would be crazy, you know what I mean? I mean, it is there, and we have to be able to use it most effectively. We are saying that people who see this as a substitute for doing political work, and most people who engaged in the social media